Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
All right, the Reds, it is the weekend there, and the Reds are back. The Reds are winning. The Reds are scoring goals. And isn't it, boss? Let's all have a big breathe out, because there was a time there where we thought they forgot how to score goals, but it turns out they've remembered again. So to talk about that, to talk about West Ham and loads of good stuff in between, which I'll tell you about in a minute when I found the email, I've got Lizzie Doyle, Mike Kearney, and I've got Callum Sanderson making his debut on the show. Callum is from Coppish, Team Coppish. Have a look for them on Twitter and on YouTube. He very kindly invited me on their show the other week. And my audio equipment failed and all the rest of it, but we're still friends. So here we go. Lizzie, big sigh of relief, wasn't it, to win last night, to score goals again, and to just play boss and remind everyone that, you know, talk of Liverpool's death as a football team has been greatly exaggerated.
It's been exaggerated, I think, Gareth. It's funny, isn't it, football, because it plays with your emotions. And I was saying this last night to my brother and my dad, like, you get so wrapped up in things emotionally that I think, like, after the Burnley game, you start panicking and start reading all things, going, oh my God, what if we don't even finish top four? And you start thinking about all these other things. But then once a little bit of order is restored, once those results went our way, the night before with the Everton-Leicester game, ending up a draw, both of them dropping points, United getting beat at home to Sheffield United, and also big lol, happy to throw in all the lols. If we could just keep saying that throughout the show, just to remind ourselves, just to make us feel better. And then I felt like the biggest boost was hearing in Klopp's press conference that Matip and Henderson were both back, and I just thought, I'm up for this now. And we won. It was a great feeling to win again, and it just made me feel really confident, actually, because of the way we played. I mean, I would have took any type of win. I would have took a scrappy win. I wouldn't have cared. But it was the way that we go to their ground with such confidence, with a bit of a patched-up team, a much better team, one of the best teams we've seen in the last couple of games, but still, you know, not our first 11, and played the way that we did and stuck it out, because the first half was a tough one. And it's just, yeah, it just made me feel good about the next upcoming games, I think.
Yeah, it was just what we needed. And by the way, the stuff in the middle is Ollie Kay from The Athletic, a brilliant journalist, if you're not onto Ollie already. He's talking to John about the Lampard sacking. And then we've got Ewan McTeer, a La Liga journalist and podcaster, with John, talking about Arsenal signing Martin Odegaard. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah. Basically, we were linked with him a while back, and he was like this wonder kid. And it's just interesting how he's just ended up at Arsenal quite quietly. So, yeah, Ewan's great. He's a La Liga journo. Scottish lad living in Madrid, so he spoke to, it's dead interesting, so boss, make sure you listen.
And then after all that, you'll get us back, and we'll be talking about West Ham and what we're thinking about that game. Callum, then, Lizzie's touched on some of the good stuff about last night, and, you know, it was pretty dominant by the end. I mean, second half, Spurs only have one shot that goes in, but, I mean, the lad's never going to hit one like that again in his life. It was a bit of a change, wasn't it, in terms of you had sort of Milner and Wijnaldum protecting a bit more, although, you know, they obviously got in the one time and scored, but it was scored in inverted commas, and it was offside. After that, though, loads and loads and loads of stuff to be positive about from Liverpool, wasn't it?
Definitely. I'll be honest, last night is the best night's sleep I've had in such a long time. Like, when that final whistle went, it was just relief. Oh, it's just beautiful. We need that feeling more often. I'll be honest, when I saw Milner starting, I was worried because Ndombele and Højbjerg have been having really good seasons at Tottenham, and I was thinking, this could really come back to bite us here. But I keep on doubting Milner, and he keeps on just proving me wrong. He's like a fine whiskey. The older he gets, the better he gets. I thought he was immense last night. Absolutely immense. Genie. He's been running to the ground this season for obvious reasons because of our squad deficiencies. And again, last night in the number six role, he was brilliant. Absolutely bossed the game. And then Thiago is he's just that source, isn't he? He's just brilliant. And seeing him play further forward as well, he's just showed what we've been missing. A lot of the times we've been snatched at chances or our final ball in the final third hasn't been great. He just seems to slow play down in his mind and just see everything and then play that ball that needs to be played. And we just, for the first time in a long time, as a team, a collective team, we look brilliant. So Mane and Salah were passing to each other. Firmino was doing what he's best at. It was a fantastic win. So, so happy.
And what about the big man, Mike? Trent? He's back?
Yeah, it's just been great to see that we've patched everything together over the past few performances, especially the two against United, where, you know, we're seeing such shoots of recovery, if you like, and now we've done a 90 there, and I couldn't pick a player really that, you know, these sort of performances with Liverpool, there's always 11 men who are playing really well. I made up for him, to be honest, because he's a young lad still, isn't he? Everyone seems to forget he's 20, 21. 22. I was like, he's still young, isn't he? But I mean, like, for him to have hit the levels, it's sort of a downfall of his own success that he's so consistent for so long. He had that United one a couple of years ago, didn't he, when he first started, where, you know, he put an apology out on his own Instagram saying sorry, he felt like he'd let people down. And, you know, he was a kid, and there's people, like, ripping into him. And to have the strength of character just to say, right, I know I'm in a bit of a tough patch here now, but I'll keep going, I'll keep getting there, I'll keep having chances. And, you know, he did well there, the second goal yesterday, to be running in to finish it. And I was just made up the fact that, you know, as I said, we've put it all together in a 90 there. And by the way, Tottenham were back, people were saying back five, it was back seven, because Højbjerg was deep and Ndombele was deep, and Mourinho was done a typical Mourinho thing, hasn't he, saying all the rubbish he does so people will stop talking about how his team failed to attack a side, you know, had perceived weaknesses and you know, stuttering performances, who had a centre mid, a centre half, and have gone there and absolutely dominated like we know we can. And it's brilliant to see. I listened, I didn't have the audio on, you know, the crowd noise. And the biggest thing I noticed all night was Henderson just talking everyone through, shouting, talking everyone through. There's a brilliant moment where it's 2-1, and the ball's going over to Robbo, and he's shouting to him, "You've got time, you've got time," he's shouting time. He shouts at time about three times, and Robertson heads it away and give it back to Tottenham. And in the end, he just went, "Listen, will you? Like, don't dead loud." I was like, this is what we've missed, you know. He's digging people out. And the next time Robinson just got rid, sort of thing. I was just made up to see. He's given everyone, he's had his own critics as well, like, as Trent, hasn't he? And over years, he's put up with it. But he's come through, and what a player, and what a big difference to have someone so vocal playing out of position, given the performance he did. And as I said, Callum said there, the best night's sleep you've had in a couple of months. It was just a happy night.
It was indeed, and it's still a happy day now. And Lizzie, the thing is, you know, would have been easy again, and we've said this so many times about this Liverpool side, it would have been easy, wouldn't it, for them to feel sorry for themselves, you know, no Fabinho. And it's now, I mean, with losing Matip as well at half time, you know, we're in this ridiculous situation now with the centre halves where it's 16 different centre-back partnerships across 20 league games, which is unbelievable. Like, Sky put up a graphic before and only showed 11. And I was like, what about the rest? So, you know, so their graphic before showed Matip and Fabinho played 6 games, Gomez and Van Dijk 3. This is in the Premier League. Phillips and Fabinho 2. Henderson and Fabinho 2. Then you've had Fabinho and Van Dijk, Matip and Van Dijk, Fabinho and Gomez, Phillips and Gomez, Matip and Gomez, Williams and Fabinho, Matip and Henderson. Last night you had Henderson and Phillips in the end. You know what I mean? It's just absolutely wild, isn't it? And yet here we are talking about a great performance and a great win. And I just think that really does... Look, we can get carried away because we're Liverpool fans and we're meant to, by the way. But the spirit is phenomenal, isn't it, in this squad?
Yeah, it is, 100%. And I do think a little bit is down to the fact that Matip did start, by the way, and sort of helped set the game up, and which allowed Liverpool to get ahead going into the break. He was really good for the first 45 minutes, and I won't go too much into detail about necessarily him being injured and what that means, but what I'm saying is I think by the time Nat Phillips come on, like Liverpool had done it all by themselves, by getting themselves into the position that they were. And like you say, against a side which I thought the first half was quite even, and you know, you mentioned that Ndombele, quite a few times thought he was excellent for Tottenham first half, and they were just confident and they had a swagger about them. And I think getting a goal like that just before half time is brilliant, because I think we've always said about this Liverpool team that how good they are at half times and how good they are at 1-0 down and stuff like that. So to get that going in, I thought was huge. And you could see the pace of the second half from the second the whistle went. God, it was quick, weren't it? It just felt like end to end. And I thought, God, this is going to be a good game of football. But as soon as I saw Liverpool set that pace, I thought, well, there's only one winner here. There's only one team who can do this. And yet, OK, Kane goes off injured, I will say that. And that was that was beneficial towards Liverpool. However, I don't think it was anything to do with how, say, poor Spurs played in the second half or how they set up, which attributed to our win. I think it was all their own doing, and they need to be so proud of themselves because... Listen, they can't change the centre-half situation. They can't go and, you know, get the money to go and spend and go and scout a player and all this and do contracts. All they can do is do what they do for 90 minutes on the pitch. And that is their job. And that is Jurgen Klopp's job. And every single person played their part last night and done their job pretty much, I want to say perfectly in the circumstances. And like I say, I think they've set themselves up so well for Sunday.
Yeah, Callum, there was a sort of cup final feel to it, which is mad at this stage of the season. Obviously, only one game past the halfway point now. But, you know, with the sort of the tightness of the league and 6 points, you know, across the top five there, you know, it did kind of feel that if Liverpool had lost it, that, you know, the noise around the club and the negativity around the club just would have spiraled into something really bad. Equally, you know, now that's probably going to happen to Spurs, and you know they're going to have to deal with all that. You know, there was a lot riding on this game, wasn't there? And it, you know, Liverpool had to perform on the night and did.
Yeah, fully agree. Going into the game, admittedly, I said if we didn't win the game, that I think we'd be out of the title race. I definitely don't think we're out of a top four race, but the title race itself, I think it would have been a far stretch to pick up another league title this season had we not won yesterday. But I think, as Lizzie said, the team just showed their mettle yesterday, and you have that cliche of it's a champion's performance. To yesterday really was, and you look at every single player, there's not one player that I'd look at there and think they didn't really pull their weight yesterday. Literally every man, even the substitutes when they came on, they did what they needed to do. And
That Phillips tackle for his yellow card.
Brilliant. I love them tackles. They're the best ones.
I can safely say I don't get to talk about my footballing ability much on this podcast because I haven't got much, but I've definitely done a few of them.
I've dished out a few and been on the receiving end of a few of them. But yeah, And I think Jurgen Klopp went into the game with probably the most pressure he'd been under since he'd been a Liverpool manager as well. And it was such a fine margin in the game because, again, going into the game, if Tottenham had won, then they'd have leapfrogged us and had a game in hand, I believe. So for us to get through that game with 3 points and then to just have that confidence boost as well of beating another a rival and just knowing we're, again, in touching distance with Man United doing what Man United do, and losing at Sheffield United, it makes the victory all that more sweet. Beautiful.
It has been a nice couple of days, hasn't it, Mike? But it could get even better if we've got to do this, but I don't want to do loads on it because it's going to be everywhere across the content the next few days. But we'd all feel a lot better, wouldn't we, Mike, if we bought a friggin' centre-half?
Oh, I mean, like, we were, I think a lot of the fan base was saying, why haven't we done it now? You know, even with the Gomez and Van Dijk injuries.
Yeah.
But, to be honest, it's almost to the point now where if they don't at least try and get one before Monday's deadline, it's pretty negligent, really, to have zero fit first team centre halves. And yeah, okay, we've got Phillips who's come in and done well. You know, Williams is a kid who's done well when he's been in, but he's had his moments where it's not been so good for him and he's been criticised. But it's mainly down to the situation that he's found himself in, the fact that he's probably sixth choice, playing first choice or second choice, third choice now. And you know, we were talking before we started, weren't we, really? They've probably been looking at it at a business decision, and you've been thinking about, it makes sense for them to spend money that they're going to in six months' time now to guarantee that their business is, you know, still in the competitions they wanted to be in, the Champions League, you know, fighting for titles and stuff like that. And you know, now, for me anyway, like, you just got to be seen to at least trying to do one. If not one, then, you know, in this, where are we? Because we've got...
You want three, don't you, Mike?
I would, yeah. I mean, but that's like...
Team of Carragher's?
I want three because, like, it's boring, isn't it? But out of our next five signings, I'd say at least three of them have got to be defenders, because Matip, I love him to bits, and his body's just letting him down a bit too much. He's a really, really good centre-half, like, easily in the top five of the Premier League, easily, when he's fully fit. You know, we've got Van Dijk and Gomez there to come back. God knows when that'll be and what level.
Yeah, we don't know what they're going to be like when they come back. That's the thing, isn't it, Mike?
So, I think we definitely need two. And I would have gone three, just so we can have maybe five going into next season and not having to have Fabinho drop in. Because even though he can do it, like, it's just massive how these injuries have took away from midfield. Henderson's out of midfield again last night, does really well. But we're losing bodies, not just in centre-half, you know, from centre-mid as well. We all thought going into the season we're stacked there. But then we've got Keita with his fitness issues. Thiago got wellied in the derby and was out for 3 months. And it's just like, the media likes to have a little go at us a bit. I think, like, that we're making these injuries up, or we're making it worse than what it actually sounds. But it is as bad as it is, because we're playing lads out of position. We're playing 19-year-old lads who are inexperienced. And, all right, Williams has a boss game against Tottenham the other month, doesn't he? And, you know, everyone's like, oh, it's great, that. But then they forget that he's going to make a mistake now and again. And he was left a bit isolated against United a couple of times through no fault of his own, and made to look worse than what he probably is. It's a long-winded answer of saying, yes, we need centre-halves and need them now.
I mean, you're right on the injuries, mate. I can't remember anything like this since sort of when we had someone called Phil Bosma at Liverpool who everyone was blaming for injuries under Graham Souness, but that's going back a long, long way. And will probably mean absolutely nothing to a lot of people listening, so up their heads there. To the middle sections then. We've got Ollie Kay now from The Athletic with John on Lampard, and then Ewan McTier, La Liga journalist, about Arsenal and that fella, what's he called? Martin Odegaard. Ever the professional there, up their heads. We'll be back in a minute talking about West Ham.
And it is John Gibbons for the weekend. I'm joined over Zoom by Oliver Kay to talk about the Frank Lampard situation and the Chelsea situation generally. And the reason I've got Oliver on is he's wrote something excellent in The Athletic. The Athletic have covered the whole story really well, actually, it must be said. And there was a long read with a lot of contributors, including Ollie, about sort of the week and what's gone on. But the thing that Oliver wrote that I want to talk about a little bit more is sort of a what's next for Frank thing. But before we get into all that, Oliver, just on the week itself, it's I wouldn't say it was a surprise he's gone, because, you know, there's been a talk a couple of weeks ago. In fact, I think it was The Athletic who got this sort of exclusive a couple of weeks ago, you know, almost straight after a game, saying that's pretty much it. So it's not a surprise. But are you surprised at all, or do you sense that people are surprised that it has happened now, that he hasn't been maybe given longer? You know, there's been a lot of talk of, you know, comparing him to like Solskjaer, who's been through tough times, and Sheffield United results aside, it seems to come through them quite well. Are you a little bit surprised that it is now, or is this just a reflection that Lampard's fully aware of, that, you know, time is not a thing at Chelsea?
Yeah, I mean, I think he said that when he arrived. I mean, he sort of acknowledged that managers, you know, not least back in his, you know, his time there as a player, I mean, managers were sacked really at the first sign of trouble, and that's never really stopped. I mean, you can go back to you know, people like Scolari and Villas Boas, and but, you know, also Ancelotti, who won the league, and basically they decided very early the next season that you know, that he was sort of on thin ice and wasn't gonna last, and he sort of drifted through that season. So, you know, that culture has remained through Mourinho second time round, through Conte, through Sarri. And I think the reality with Lampard was that at the first sign of trouble, he was going to lose his job, same as everybody else has. And the one thing which doesn't really add up to me is that if you're going to make that kind of appointment, you know, you don't hire Frank Lampard necessarily to get you into the top four or to win the next league title or to make you competitive in the Champions League. The reasoning behind the appointment was about breaking that sort of cycle of boom and bust. And it was about sort of handling the challenges that they now face with the transfer ban and with Abramovich sort of previously not putting as much money as they wanted to. And they wanted to sort of break that cycle and start integrating some of their youth players, which is something they've, you know, Chelsea's academy over the last 10 years has been brilliant. Chelsea's integration of those academy players has been sort of borderline disgraceful. And it was with a view to changing that they appointed Lampard, and he has done that. And obviously, if you're, you know, integrating academy players and, you know, reducing the average age of the team, and then you've got the influx of new players, you know, you don't expect it to be a sort of steep upward curve, really. You expect it to be a sort of, you know, you expect probably a painful first season and a better second season. They were having a very good second season, and so, you know, they were top in early December. I think nearly everybody was top in December, it felt like. But and then, you know, I think they've lost five out of the last eight games, or they lost five of the next eight games, and he was sacked. And it's, so am I surprised? No, because it's Chelsea. But, you know, I don't think they should have appointed Frank Lampard if they were going to sack him at the first sign of trouble.
So in terms of what next for Frank Lampard then, and that is the title of the piece, yeah. I guess, I mean, there's two ways of looking at it, isn't there? And you sort of explore both in the article, is that it's both up to him and other chairman, because he needs people to give him a job, but also he needs to know what's right for him and what he has the sort of appetite for. To sort of answer the first question first a little bit. You talk in your article about the fact that obviously Lampard made mistakes, and obviously there was issues around, you know, inexperience that we saw, but that you also felt that there was enough in there and he showed enough that will interest other chairmen, that will interest other people who are looking for a young manager with good ideas and someone who can provide leadership.
Yeah, I think, look, Frank Lampard is somebody who, because of the profile he has, and he's, you know, he's a huge figure at Chelsea, and he's maybe not very well liked amongst Liverpool supporters and Man United supporters, and certainly West Ham supporters and Tottenham supporters, etc. So, you know, he's part of that, you know, English golden generation, so-called golden generation, where the people who don't like those, you know, the people who don't love those players tend not to like them. So you get a very sort of black and white view of it. And I suppose the really ultra critical point of view is, oh, he did nothing, you know, he shouldn't have got the job at Derby, he didn't get Derby up, he shouldn't have got the job at Chelsea, he won nothing with Chelsea. That would be what some people, you know, some people are very dismissive of what he's done. Now, did he get the job at Derby because of his profile? Yes, basically. The same as, you know, so many ex-players. Mm-hmm. You know, you could go back to Kenny Dalglish, you could go back to Matt Busby as a Liverpool and Man City player getting a job unproven at Man United in whatever that was, 1945 or something.
It's not a new story, yeah.
Exactly. So that is not a new story. And yet you've got, people will say, well, he didn't do a good job at Derby. He did do a good job at Derby. He didn't get them up, but again, it was about changing the culture, bringing younger players in and playing a different type of football. And he did that. And he, you know, with a very different team, different, less experienced team, he got them to the playoff final. They lost to Villa, you know, losing to a team which is, you know, probably two-thirds of the team, which is now, or half of the team, which is now doing well in the Premier League. I don't think that was a disgrace. It wouldn't normally get you the Chelsea job, don't get me wrong, but, you know, he did a good job at Derby. I felt he did a good job at Chelsea, or was doing fine until the last couple of weeks when, you know, what happens every time at Chelsea, you know, the players just sort of, because there's that culture, they kind of, they give up, really. You know, they kind of give up on the manager and they start, you know, I think you can say that of a lot of the players, they sort of started to sort of stop taking responsibility. And so, I have no doubt, because I know from people in the game that there are people who, you know, influential people at Premier League clubs who feel that Lampard was doing an impressive job, you know, a month or two ago, and they like what he was doing. They, you know, I think there are people who will, you know, whether it's, you know, a mid-table Premier League team or a lower Premier League team or upper Championship team, or maybe, you know, maybe Celtic, if they wanted to sort of take the Gerrard Lampard rivalry to a new level in future. I have no doubt there will be people who will be sufficiently impressed by Lampard to want to give him a job.
So I guess it's on him then, what he wants to do. And it is tough in a way, isn't it? Because he's a Chelsea boy, obviously. You know, he comes through the West Ham Academy, but he's, you know, when you think of Lampard, you think of Chelsea and to a certain extent, vice versa. And so, you know, it is, you know, I mean, you can have a debate on whether he was right to take that job at that time. And I've seen Jamie Carragher, amongst other people, say that he might have been better doing the John Terry route or even the Steven Gerrard route, if you like, and taking the time. But it's almost a moot point because he hasn't now. But I think it does make his next step a little bit tricky, doesn't it? Because anything to him will feel like, I guess, a bit of a backward step, because Chelsea is a huge club, but also because of, you know, how much, you know, he will have wanted to be a Chelsea manager one day.
Yeah, and I mean, I think with a lot of these sort of high-profile ex-players who are going into management now, I think they go into management with one or two jobs in mind. I think, you know, Gerrard is loving what he's doing at Rangers, and you can tell he's fiercely committed to it. But, you know, I don't think it's a secret that he went into management hoping one day to be Liverpool manager. Lampard has said himself that when he went into management, he hoped to be Chelsea manager, and he got that job at, what was it, 42.
Yeah.
Now he's lost that job. You know, he's only been retired as a player 4 years, and he's had that job and he's lost it. And now he's got to think, right, well, do I want to be a manager, and do I want to, you know, achieve more in management? And I'm told that he feels very much that he was just getting going, really. And, you know, he might set his sights on the England job or, you know, whatever. I mean, I think the days of people thinking the England job is, you know, you have to be the best of the best to get the England job. You know, I don't think that's ever really been the case. I mean, how many of the European Cup winning managers have ended up managing England? Gareth Southgate got sacked at Middlesbrough and ended up managing England. I think there's probably a much easier route to England or whatever. You know, I could see Lampard at Southampton or a Brighton or a, you know, Crystal Palace. It couldn't really be a Northern club, could it? I think if we were having these same conversations, if it was Steven Gerrard and the Liverpool job had come up, you know, 2 years ago after he'd been at Rangers a year and he'd gone in and he'd done a good, you know, decent job, and the fans liked what he was doing, and he was, you know, bringing the academy players in, and they sacked him at the first sign of trouble after 18 months, I think Liverpool fans would be quite defensive of Gerrard, the manager, and saying, look, don't write him off. He was doing a good job in here. You don't understand what he was trying to do. And you'd want to see him go again. And I think, you know, I don't expect all of your listenership to be as sympathetic towards Frank Lampard as they would be to Steven Gerrard. But no, Lampard's a guy who I would think, look, you can't ever tell whether somebody's got the quality or the ingredients to be a good manager, but I'd say that Lampard and Gerrard, in different ways, are two that make you think, you know, two rare ex-players, really, that you make you think that the combination of sort of steeliness and, you know, drive and charisma, aura and football intellect, you think is probably there. And it's really a case of how their careers go and what opportunities come up and whether they're able to, you know, pick themselves up after the inevitable stumbles.
Yeah, is it as much about personal appetite then as anything else? Because, you know, we, as you say, different people have different opinions on his ability, and you've sold him as a coach there very, very well. But I think there's almost a case of, well, you know, he management is such a 24/7 job. You know, he doesn't need the money, you know, to a certain extent. And, you know, is it a case of, you know, for him, will it, you know, do I really want to, you mentioned Southampton there, do I really want to, you know, slip down to Southampton, you know, away from my family and throw myself fully into that, really, when, what is the goal sort of from that? Is it almost about him setting himself new goals, I suppose, and what they might be?
Yeah. And I mean, it's, I guess he is somebody who, you know, really was felt to have absolutely sort of surpassed all expectations of him as a player and, yeah, you know, absolutely striving. You know, people say Gerrard was a natural talent and Lampard was a sort of more manufactured talent. And that's, you know, that's, I think he would probably say, look, I wasn't bad, you know, but he would say, look, you know, he had to work relentlessly and drive towards something. And for the moment he was in management, he's been driving towards Chelsea and then trying to drive towards being a success at Chelsea. And then I guess, yeah, the goals change, don't they? And you know, maybe it becomes about proving Chelsea wrong and trying to get back there or trying to get England or whatever. I just, you know, I think those characters that we're talking about, whether it's Gerrard or Lampard or whoever, you know, even Thierry Henry, someone like that, I think that the motivation that those guys have is something that probably most of us mere mortals just don't really identify with or understand in terms of their, you know, what motivates them. But I don't think they'll be, you know, I don't think any of those guys are people who want to manage into their sort of 60s or anything like that. I think all of them want these sort of Zidane type, Guardiola type, elite management careers for, you know, to go in, make a real impact and, you know, probably retire with a load of medals, but not long after you turn 50. And, you know, that's really hard to do once you've been sacked once. But yeah, I think that will be the goal. I think, that there'll be a club probably willing to take a chance on him at some point in the next, you know, I always think with that type of person, where it's a younger manager and where it's a lot of it's about sort of, some, they're not promising guaranteed results. They're promising a sort of different approach and youth and all that kind of thing. And I often think that's the kind of appointment someone makes in the summer rather than in the winter months when you're desperate for points on the board and short term objectives. So I think probably he goes away and gets a job in the summer, whether it's a Premier League job, whether it's a Championship job, you know, abroad. You know, Scotland, America, you know, Spain, France, Germany, who knows? I've no doubt he will get another job. And, yeah, he'll be determined to prove people wrong.
We shall see. Huge thanks to Ollie. As I said, at the top, you can read all this stuff at The Athletic. And, yeah, they've covered the Chelsea story very well. But obviously, it's a great place to read Liverpool stuff as well. But thanks a lot to Ollie. And, yeah, now back to the main show. And it's John Gibbons with the Last Fan Standing quiz. And Last Fan Standing is an app that you can download on your phone and you can play quizzes. And it's for all fans, but obviously we're interested in the Liverpool ones because we're Liverpool supporters. And also, if you do the Liverpool quizzes, you get me and or Neil doing them. What a delight for you. It's completely free. Download it. You can get stuck in. And they do quizzes every night, but also they do predictor quizzes around the games as well. So we're going to have a bit of a demonstration of what Last Fan Standing's all about. And I was going to say a victim. That makes it sound awful. Volunteer, I've got Frank Byrne. Frank, nice one for jumping on at last minute, obviously, because I'm very disorganised.
Cheers, John, nice one. Glad to be here.
So, just before we start, you're from Cork. How's life in Cork at the moment?
It's not great. We're in lockdown the same as you in Liverpool. You know, missing getting over to the games and all that. But yeah, it's as good as it can be.
So, do you get over quite a bit, do you?
Yeah, I'm quite lucky. Me, my dad, my brothers, we have a membership card each with kind of all the credits and stuff. So we get over sort of once a month kind of time. So the last one I had was Southampton last February. So it's kind of been a year now. So the longest gap I've had. hopefully we get back soon.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, I think Liverpool as a city misses the people coming for the game as well. Like, because obviously Liverpool's a vibrant city, but like around the match, you know, people coming over, it just takes on a whole new energy. And I'm sure for you guys, you're missing the pubs as much as you are the stadium.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's the full weekend, honestly, coming over early Saturday and just, you know, just having a good time from the whole 2 days you're over and the night out. And you know, as well, people are always interested in speaking to you when they hear your accent, you know.
Yeah.
And they want to know where you're from and everything, so it's great.
I've got to ask as well before we get going, because you are from Cork. Did you go to the last live show we've done now in Cork? Did you go?
Yeah, I did. I was there. It went off, I have to say. There was a couple of stories being told that probably shouldn't have been, you know, Michael Edwards ratings and all that kind of stuff.
Well, we won't give too much away. Basically, what happened was I didn't go and I'm kicking myself. So basically, we did three live shows across the weekend in Ireland, and the last one was Cork. And I think the lads basically did have a heavy weekend and they'd had a good time on the Guinness and all that, and said, should we do something a bit different? So rather than sort of a traditional live show, I think they just told a few stories from over the years and a few Anfield Rap stories that you know wouldn't get told, let's say, on a recorded show. So I think it was, but the lads who went always talk about Cork as like a boss night, and I think they got well looked after as well. Like,
yeah, no, it was a good night, therefore fair play to them.
And yeah, and me and Craig have saved ourselves for an American tour that never happened a month later. So Cork, hopefully it won't be the last ever Anfield Rap live show.
Definitely not. I'm looking forward to you coming again, I have to say.
Well, next time I'm definitely coming, let me tell you, not missing it. But anyway, we'll get on with the quiz. So the way Last Fan Standing works is that you carry on going until you get one wrong. And so that's what we're going to do. So the record so far this season is 3. We've only had 2, I must say. So we've had 3-1. It is to be. So we'll see how we go, but that's how the Last Fan Standing quiz works, so we're going to go with that. So it's all about Anfield. So you say you've been to Anfield quite a few times, you should be, he says, all right on this, Frank, but we'll get going. Question one is, which of these is not currently the name of a stand at Anfield? So which is not currently the name of a stand at Anfield? The Cop, the Centenary Stand, or the Main Stand?
The Centenary.
Correct. It's the Kenny Dalglish Stand, of course, now changed in 2017. So we're flying. You got one. Yeah. Question two. Who is Bob Paisley seen carrying at Anfield? So there's a statue of Bob Paisley at Anfield. Who is he carrying? Is it Emlyn Hughes or Ian Callaghan?
Ian Callaghan?
No, it's Emlyn Hughes, mate.
Honestly.
Do you know what? It's only a year old, so you might not have seen it yet, but it's Bob Paisley carrying Emlyn Hughes. It's at the corner of the Main Stand of the Cop. And every time you walk past it now, mate, you're going to curse it. You go...
Yeah, I can't picture it, to be honest. That's weird. Anyway.
So you got one anyway. But you played and hopefully you enjoyed it. It's been nice talking to you, mate, anyway. And hopefully...
Yeah, I'm joined second. Do you know what I mean? I'll take that. Like,
join second, and hopefully, mate, we'll have a beer soon, eh? As soon as Liverpool is open, we'd love to have, well, all of you, really. But we'll get you over for a beer soon, eh?
Yeah, nice one. Cheers, Thatchan. I appreciate it.
Tom, man, cheers.
All the best.
And everyone, download the Last Fan Standing app. It's completely free. Android, iPhone, and all that. Get it on your app and play. And I'm sure next time Frank does plays, you'll be better. You'll be texting me saying, I've just got 6.
Honestly, yeah.
Tom, man. And it is John Gibbons for the weekend. I'm delighted to be joined over Zoom by Ewan McTeer, who's a Scottish journalist who's working out in Spain and an expert on Spanish football. So, Ewan, welcome back to the Anfield Rap.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I want to talk to you about Martin Odegaard and his move to Arsenal on loan this week. But I'd like to go all the way back, if you don't mind, because it's an interesting story, isn't it? And I'll be honest, obviously... From a Liverpool point of view, there was a lot of interest in Martin Odegaard going right back to when he was a wonder kid. And then he went to Real Madrid. And in my head, he'd become a bit of a Freddy Adu. Do you know what I mean? In terms of someone who was much hyped and then sort of disappeared. But he's had obviously a recent renaissance, and which has ended up with him at least on loan at Arsenal. So if you could talk us through, if you don't mind, and I know I'm asking you to cry 5 years into 5 minutes here, the sort of the Odegaard Spain story and how sort of he ended up there, if you like, and how it's gone for him.
Yeah, so it does go back to that time in 2015 in that winter window where there was this wonder kid from Norway most of Europe's clubs, Liverpool certainly, Real Madrid too, but several other ones as well were interested in, because, you know, he debuted with Norway's national team when he was 15, which, you know, is pretty crazy. So there was so much interest in him. Real Madrid won that battle because more than anything, they managed to convince his family that it was a good opportunity, that they had a really good academy he could fit into, that he could play with the B team, that he could train with the first team at the same time, and then that he could maybe go out on a loan and eventually play to the first team. And more or less, that promise has been met by Real Madrid. When he arrived, he went straight into Castilla, the B team there, where his coach was none other than Zinedine Zidane at that time. He played there at the same time, though. He was training with the first team, with all the legends, with Cristiano Ronaldo, with everybody. He got to make his debut with the first team in the last round of the league season, breaking a Real Madrid record for the youngest player. And then he started going out on a couple of loans. He went to the Eredivisie. And to be honest, in Spain, people kind of lost track of him because nobody was really watching Dutch football. But the reports you heard were good. And then last season, we really got to see him because he came back to Spain and went out on loan to Real Sociedad. Now, that was supposed to be a two-year loan. He went in the summer of 2019. But, well, then the world changed just a little bit, and Real Madrid had no money to sign. The coronavirus pandemic happened, so they decided to bring him back a year early so they could have some reinforcement for their squad without spending any money. So he came back this season, hardly played, and now he's out on loan again, this time off to Arsenal.
So, I mean, thanks so much for that. Can you tell us a little bit more about that year at Sociedad then? Because the Sociedad, obviously, you know, a big club, famous club in Spain. From what I can see, he was playing most weeks and certainly getting a regular game. So how did he do effectively, and how did he kick on, and what did people finally sort of in Spain, as you say, get to see of him?
Yeah, I mean, he was absolutely brilliant. In the first full month of the La Liga season, he won the September Player of the Month award for all of La Liga. He won a few other ones for Real Sociedad's Player of the Month, which, by the way, the prize for that is a big fish from the the local supermarket, which is a sponsor. So he won a few of those Real Sociedad Player of the Month big fishes.
Amazing.
There's a few photos of that, which is good fun. And no, he was just brilliant. And I think until the lockdown, until the pandemic, he was maybe, after Messi, the best player in La Liga. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that. He was absolutely fantastic. Like you say, he played almost every week, played almost every minute. And he was playing in his perfect role, that number 10 role, just behind the striker in a sort of 4-2-3-1. And yeah, the team was built around him and he just absolutely flourished. After lockdown, he had a couple of injury niggles and didn't play quite as much, didn't play quite as well. But until March, he was, yeah, it's fair to say, one of the best players in La Liga. And there was, yeah, great excitement about him for a potential return to Real Madrid, which was supposed to be in the summer of 2021, but came a little bit early.
So why has he struggled to get into the Real team? I mean, obviously, you know, the obvious answer is Real Madrid have got very good players, but what is it? Is it sort of position he plays? Is it, you know, well, I'm putting words in your mouth. Why can't he get in the Real team?
No, I'll take the words you just said, because that's the two answers I would say. I mean, why can't he get in? Well, two words, Modric and Kroos. And then the other thing you touched on there as well, it's the system. Real Madrid don't play that 4-2-3-1. They've never really had that playmaker who floats around. That's why Isco struggled so much as well. And Isco is an even more established player than Odegaard. Isco's a player who Zidane likes. And even Isco can't really get into the team. So, yeah, it's a matter of there not really being a position for him. But the interesting thing was, right at the start of the season, Zidane did change the formation a little bit and created a sort of system with Odegaard playing behind two strikers, with Benzema and Jovic together. But he started one game, didn't go too well, and then was taken off at halftime in the second of the season. And since then, he's really struggled to get back into the team. So, yeah, I think it is just the team wasn't built for him, and especially Zidane's way of playing. Zidane is a very loyal guy as well. He trusts the players who've won him three Champions Leagues. Or, you know, it's been hard for him to break into the team because, to be honest, the plan wasn't for him to be there at this point. I think he was to arrive when Modric was becoming past it, but this season Modric certainly isn't past it.
So, should Arsenal fans be excited then? We've got at least one who works for the Anfield Rap. When I say at least one, I don't think we've got any saying ones, but let's just say one. But obviously, you know, Arsenal fans, you were maybe listening to this, you know, because it is one of the free shows. And just generally, you know, I guess fans of Premier League football, should we be excited that we're getting this player over for the next few months?
I think so, because I think Odegaard's just a really good player to watch, and I think Arsenal is a team where he can play the kind of football that suits him. He can play in a system that can sort of be tailored to him. It won't be built around him as much as it was at Real Sociedad. You know, Arsenal do have several other good players. But yeah, I think you can get excited. The only question, the only sort of fear you might have is when Dani Ceballos arrived at Arsenal from Real Madrid, it started very well and then very quickly faded. And I mean, I don't know, it's just the Premier League is a very different league. It's a very different type of football. And I think the main winner of this loan is Real Madrid. They want Odegaard to play minutes over the second half of the season. He wasn't going to do that at Real Madrid. And if he can go to a tougher league, toughen up a little bit, play that Premier League way, play against really top quality opposition every week, I think Real Madrid benefit a lot from that. If Arsenal only have him for 6 months, I don't know if they're the one who get the most out of this deal, but still, they are getting a great player for next to nothing, a loan fee and paying his wages. So you've got to take that when it's offered to you in these times when nobody really has money. So yeah, definitely cause for optimism and excitement, but at the same time, have to remember that he's a player who's only there in the short term, and he's a player who hasn't played much and has had a few injuries over the last year. So he is a bit removed from that player that really led it up with Real Sociedad, because that was now basically more than a year ago.
Yeah, I guess so. I think that is fair. And just to finish up, Ewan, you know, what do you know about him as a person and as a man? Because he is 22 now, you know, yeah. And so it's still sort of quite young, still younger than me. But, you know, what do you know about him, you know, as a person? And I guess how he's coped, if that's the right word, with quite an unusual footballer's path, you know, to have all this hype, to sort of be going to Real Madrid and then to be sort of shifted around here, there and everywhere, if you like. It's an unusual, well, it's not completely unusual, because it does happen a little bit, but I'd say he's a kind of extreme example really of someone who's had this sort of type of career. You know, has it ever seemed, you know, to any part of it to get him down or anything? Has he ever, you know, sort of, you know, seem to be someone who's believed the hype, and is that something he struggled with? You know, I don't know anything about him. So, you know, what do you know in terms of, you know, how he seemed off the pitch, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, we've all kind of seen him grow up here in Madrid, because, you know, it is 5 years now since he first came as a, you know, 16, 17-year-old with the world at his feet. And obviously when Real Madrid sign a player who's that young and do it for a reason, all eyes are on him. So even B team games, he was, you know, the one everyone sought for an interview after the game. He was, you know, the player who, even when he went on loan, everybody wanted to interview. So he's been in the spotlight for so long. And I think going to Real Sociedad was quite good, because San Sebastian there, it's quite a small city. It's a nice, really beautiful city. I think he made some really good friends there in that dressing room, especially Alexander Isak, the Swedish striker who's still there at Real Sociedad. They formed a good bond, the same with a few of the Spanish Basque players there, because he speaks the language now. And yeah, all you hear about Odegaard is that he is just a really good guy. He works hard. He wants to make it. It's not gone to his head. And I think that's because his father has played a big role as well. His father used to play. So he knows, not at this level, but he knows the world of football. He's managed a lot of Odegaard's affairs. So I think he's been kept quite grounded. And I think that tends to happen when you have players who come from the north of Europe. You don't really get too many divas coming out of Scandinavia. Everyone seems very grounded and down to earth when you come from that part of the world. And Odegaard is just another example of that. Everybody says good things about him. It's just a case of the circumstances not always quite falling for him. And you just hope that this circumstance at Arsenal does fall for him. But at the same time, there's so many variables in this one that we'll just have to wait and see how it goes.
We will have to wait and see, but we'll follow it with even more interest now. Huge thanks to Ewan for joining us. You can follow him on Twitter. It's EMcTier on Twitter, at EMcTier, if you want to give him a follow. Thanks very much, Ewan, and we'll go back to the rest of the show.
Okay, thanks to everyone there. Interesting stuff. Callum, West Ham then. How are you feeling about this one? And are you feeling any different now, having seen Liverpool do what they did against Spurs?
Yeah, I'm an absolute sucker when it comes to these things. So because we won the other night, I just expect a win now. I don't know how that's going to affect me going into the game or after the game, depending on results. But I do think we should win this game. West Ham have been really good this season, kind of flown under the radar with how they performed and the results they've got. And then even when you look at games that they've lost, such as the Man United game, they kind of got robbed in that game because I think Pogba's goal, which was either the equaliser or the goal that made it 2-1, that should never have been allowed because the ball went off play, but it still got given. And I think that changes the dynamic of that game. But Mikel Antonio has got a great record against us. He seems to turn into Ronaldo when he plays against us. So I'm hoping he doesn't have a good game against us. I think Souček has had a really good season. He reminds me of sort of your old school midfielder who just gets in the box late and gets on the end of things. And he's just been really good. Defensively, West Ham have been good as well. However, we can't get out of their defence. And I'd expect them to play a three at the back. And recently, when we played teams with three at the back, we've tended to do quite well. So I think we'll have a good game and I think we'll pull out the result.
Lizzie, how are you feeling about this one? I mean, West Ham, as Callum says, are currently flying. And the recent form is pretty flawless, really. I mean, the 3-2 against Crystal Palace away. 4-0 against Doncaster Rovers. You'd expect that one, obviously. They beat West Brom 2-1. They beat Burnley 1-0. They won 1-0 away at Stockport County. Again, you'd expect that. And they won 1-0 away at Everton. Again, you'd expect that. Can't be taking against Everton. Get in! but yeah, how are you feeling about it, Lizzie? Because, you know, there is a bit of a thing about they've played well and the Antonio thing and all the rest of it. But you can swerve it on its head, can't you, and say, you know, their defenders will not want to be facing Sadio Mane, who now looks back on form, Mo Salah, who looks more like his normal self, Bobby being Bobby, etc., etc., etc.
Yeah, I feel like sort of two ways about it. So when I think about it that way and think about like them coming up against us, I feel dead confident, but I just feel like the centre-half thing shook us a little bit, shook me a little bit, with the idea of Matip being out, which is back to Fabinho plus one, and Fabinho sound is whoever that plus one is. Now, I think Nat Phillips would be a decent one for this game. And I feel like if we had Nat Phillips alongside Fabinho, it might be all right. However, I just look at someone like Antonio and think that he'll be licking his lips at the idea of someone like Nat Phillips. And I don't want to do the lad down, but he's not the quickest, is he? However, what I will say with Nat Phillips, why he could come in handy, is that West Ham are quite a physical team, aren't they? They're tall, and we've lacked a lot of height. And the thing is, they'll be trying to go for us on set pieces and stuff. And I feel like he'll probably shore us up a little bit in that area. I just feel like as brilliant as he was the other night, I don't want Henderson back there. But again, I suppose at the time of recording this, we don't know whether Fabinho is going to be ready or not, do we either? So there is a couple of things I am concerned about. And I also think the fact that it's away, the fact that they're riding on confidence, I do think it'll be tricky, actually. I think, weirdly, probably a bit more tricky than Tottenham. I don't know why. I've just got like a bit of a funny feeling about it. But listen, you can win or lose any game, do you know what I mean? This season's anyone's, it feels like. So, however, I think we all know that we are the better team. We are better than West Ham, yet they've had a great run. But I mean, the scores you're reading out there, you know, there's no like massive shocks and they're not running away with games, do you know what I mean? But they're doing what they do very well. And I think if Liverpool can do what they do very well, then we'll come out the better team and we'll come out on top.
Yeah, Mike, they were comfortably beaten by Chelsea last month. You know, the last six obviously do look good in terms of their results. But as I say, beaten 3-0 by Chelsea, and, you know, Chelsea have been hot and cold, it's fair to say. Also as well, just, I mean, I don't know how much people read into these things. Some people like it, some people don't. But West Ham are winless in 9 Premier League matches against Liverpool, now drawn 2, lost 7. It's their worst run against Liverpool since 2000 to 2007, apparently. Also as well, we're unbeaten at that new ground of theirs, that crap new ground of theirs. So there's little things like that kicking about it. Sort of what I mean by this as well, Mike, is that, you know, everyone's been praising West Ham and talking about how well they've done and where they are in the table and all this, but this is bollocks on the table time. This is when you've got to prove yourself when you play a side like Liverpool, We're not Stockport County, do you know what I mean? And so it's like they're going to have to bring an A game to beat Liverpool, and probably the other way around as well. We're going to have to play well to beat them.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a Moyes team coming up against Liverpool, and we all know how when any team have been in any sort of decent form that he's managed over the past, he's come and shut up shop. And okay, one of them was Everton, and they were always made up with the points at Anfield or trying to nick a win at Goodison and stuff like that. But this West Ham side, they'll be thinking, why can't we have a go? And as much as that can be a negative for us in terms of them playing well and doing well, it's also a negative for them, because if they think too much about, we'll have a go and we'll get at them. They've got good delivery from set pieces, haven't they, with Cresswell. The right wing back design this season, he's all right, that's Soufal. He's got a couple of assists. As you say, Antonio's back. He's sort of found as Fellaini. Don't want to do that Souček down, but he's a big lad who gets on the end of things. He's got his Moyes team, hasn't he? He's got his Fellaini, he's got his big lads. And, they can cause us problems, absolutely. They can. Like, I was half saying it before about Spurs, when Mourinho comes out and does all his usual crap, trying to take the deflection away. If you're a manager against this Liverpool team at the moment, you've got to think, they have got an issue at centre half. We have seen them struggle against teams who compact, and like Burnley got a pen in the end and beat us. But you can literally point to that result and go, look, that is a way to skin this cat in terms of beating Liverpool. Defend stoutly, get a chance, take our chances. And as he said before, Antonio will probably be licking his lips there. He's got at least one inexperienced centre half and one centre mid playing midfield. Centre midfielder playing centre half next week. Whether it's Fabinho or Henderson, we won't know yet. But he'll be thinking, why not? And we've just got to take that. And I've seen Robertson talking before it came on. He said, we can't have that being a one off. It needs to be the level that we need to achieve in every game now. So we've already got one player talking like that. The talk in the dressing room for our lads will be same again, because we've got to put the foot down now. Massive win in terms of keeping us going forward. We're only 4 points behind City at the moment. They've got a game in hand, but they've also got to come to us. So we've got West Ham and Brighton before we get to the City game, and we've got to go and win them too, and there's no reason why we can't. And everyone seems to be clicking at the right time in terms of going forwards, and I'm looking forward to it now. And if we'd have drawn last night, or it would have been a sticky loss, or like just another one of them feeling like, we're in it again here. West Ham would have felt a lot different, but waking up today, seeing how the players are reacting to last night and going forward now, you're just, right, we've got to get in here. We'll find a way somehow against West Ham, even if it's like a struggle. But I don't think it will be. I think we'll have a decent game against West Ham and hopefully come out on top by a goal or two.
Well, Callum, we can talk up Antonio if we want. And he's a nice fella. But, we can also get stuck into him. And also as well, I think if you were listening to kneesupmotherbrown.com or whatever, right now, they're probably saying, Mo Salah scored in six of his last seven against West Ham. So like just as we bemoan the fact that Antonio scored four in six against us, Mo Salah always, in inverted commas, scores against them. There's lots of things for them to worry about, is what I'm saying here.
Yeah, agreed. And also, Ox is another player that seems to play well against West Ham. Obviously, don't know if he'll come back into the team, but we have got quite a few players that do seem to pull a good game out of the bag against West Ham. Salah, I think, has been unfairly criticised a lot this season. You look at his numbers, and he should have had a goal last night as well in the Tottenham game. But you look at his numbers, and again, he's top goal scorer in the league, one of the top assist makers, and yet people are still saying, maybe we should cash in on him. You don't cash in on your best player, you just don't do it. So I expect him to have a good game. Mane hasn't been himself this season, but again, he's now starting to show signs that he's starting to return to form and starting to play a bit better. And Bobby, in the game against Man United, got 2 assists. The game against Tottenham, again, got a goal and played really well. So that front three, if they click, I don't see how West Ham deal with them. And then in midfield, depending on who we go with in midfield, I think we can just squeeze the team and just suffocate them and just dominate possession, dominate the ball, create chances. and we can really get out of these lot.
Absolutely. Well, Lizzie, what you know, you mentioned before that we obviously haven't got the latest team news and things like that. We haven't seen, you know, the press conference or things like that, and things will likely change before the game. But knowing what we know, what do you want to see team-wise? What do you expect team-wise from Liverpool?
Well, if they're right about Fabinho just being a little knock and a precaution, I think the back line has to be Fabinho and Phillips. I think with Matip out, Phillips is your next option. There is a shout for Fabinho and Henderson, and playing the same midfield and asking that midfield to go again, because I thought they done very well that midfield. So I'd be up for any of those options, but I would like to see Henderson return to the midfield if it was me. So I'd go Fabinho and Nat Phillips again for the height, for the set pieces and stuff like that. Because as we've said, Moyes loves big lads. Nat Phillips a big lad. And he said his strength is in the air. That might mean that we have to adapt our game ever so slightly and play a bit, you know, our line a bit deeper. But I'd like to see a midfield of Thiago, Henderson and either Milner or Gini, I think, because it's no coincidence to me that the front three were playing better with a more balanced midfield. Trent was playing better. Like, there's a lot of knock-on effects to having a midfield that's balanced. You can talk as much as you want about the centre-halves. They affect the whole team, of course they do. But I think having that assurance behind them with Joel Matip first off and then Phillips coming in and doing a good job, I think allows that midfield to just be a little bit more risky. And also, like we said, Milner and Gini drop back quite a bit to help out. So I think those formulas worked well. So Henderson in midfield ideally, but if not, that Milner, Gini, Thiago, ask them to go again.
Mike, you know, on the champions, on the 4-1 shots to retain the title, the mighty Reds, Jordan Henderson, I would agree with Lizzie that you want to see him in midfield, but equally I think it's worth saying that despite only playing a handful of games there, he's making a decent fist to play in that centre half, isn't he?
Yeah, you can see it. You can see him growing into it, really. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kept a clean sheet against Man United there as well, and again, if you're a fan of the other teams coming to Anfield like the and having a go or coming up against Liverpool with centre mid to centre half, you're going away disappointed that we haven't had more of a go there. And I know we've had you know, a bit of a run of it where we lost to Southampton and Burnley, but it's by the odd goal. It's not like by four or by three, is it? So you know, we have got problems, but the people that are doing a job at centre half are actually doing fairly well. Whether that's by design of the teams, just a little bit deeper, everyone's a little bit more restrained. But I thought last night, and the first goal against United the other day as well, is where we've got Trent and Robertson high and wide, we're stretching teams again, going forward again. And I just think we're sort of getting used to this idea now. Henderson can probably think to himself, you know what, I've had a few games here this season. By the way, I totally agree with Lizzie and yourself there. He's got it. I'd like him in midfield, please. But if we get Henderson playing until he's 35 and he does a bit more at centre half than maybe he anticipated he ever would, it's a way forward for him to stay in this team for as long as possible. Because, like I mentioned before, he's a vocal fella, and he's a leader, and he won't have anyone dropping standards. And you know, especially himself, he'll think, you know what, I'm playing centre half, but I can't give that as an excuse as being any different. I've got to still have my passing levels, I've got to be there, I've got to read the game well. So you know, it's horrible, isn't it? We'd obviously all love Van Dijk to be playing and Gomez and this never to be a conversation, but for it to have been dealt with by Henderson and Fabinho, by the way, as well, and as you know, there's even some chat that was saying Fabinho is one of the best centre-halves in the league when he's on it, because all the goal line clearances is brilliant, his blocking, and his tackles can sometimes be a bit rash, because he's used to diving in midfield and pinching the ball back on the halfway line, not the edge of his own box, which is the problem when you're playing centre mid centre-half. But all that considered, you know, to be where we are, And by the way, we should be 4 points better off because of VAR. I'll never not say that about the season. I'll always be the old fella saying we are VAR did us at Goodison and at Brighton. I'd always point that out. We should be better off than what we actually are.
Hey, big John Moss did us a favour last night, lad.
Oh, well, I mean, about time. We're in the 20th game of the season. That's the first goal we've had turned over in our favour with VAR. So that meant Liverpool, yeah. 20 games to have one decision and a goal chalked off, like, so yeah. I agree it's got to be Phillips for me at centre half of the weekend, and hopefully I have Henderson midfield, and I will go again with the same midfield again. I think he'll play, we've got Brighton in the midweek, haven't we, at home, yeah. So I think that's where he'll bring the likes of maybe Shaq or Curtis into midfield and change it up. But as from last night, we're going into Sunday, you know, I'd be like, let's go again with as close to that team as we can, maybe, and go again. That's all we need to do, is just go again, and that's what Dale'll do, I think.
Yeah. And Callum, just finally, on the final whistle last night against Spurs, the camera pan to Jurgen Klopp, and you're just seeing him do like a big yes outburst, and I think that was how we all felt. And I just think, you know, the way he manages the football club and the way we are about it, and the whole thing, it's quite emotional. You know, it's not dry, it's not passionless, it's not Man City. and I just think, you know, I just think, you know, that being there now, that sort of collective clenched fist about Liverpool makes me think that we can definitely go on and win on Sunday now.
Yeah, agreed. I think we even saw an outburst when Firmino scored his goal and the camera panned to Klopp, and you just saw him looking up to the sky as if to say, finally.
Yeah, thanks on God.
We've got a goal. So thank you, Fowler. Thank you. Really needed that goal. but at the end of the game, just seeing the relief. And I know, obviously, Jurgen Klopp's German, so he obviously didn't grow up in Liverpool. He probably didn't support Liverpool growing up. But you just get the sense that he just loves the club so much, and he just gets it so much. So me being a fan and seeing someone like Jurgen Klopp leading our club, it fills me with pride. Like, I go into arguments with rival fans and I say, my manager's the best manager in the world, and there's silence. What can you say? He's won. He's a brilliant man manager. Yes, his selection can be questionable. His substitutes could be questionable, but there's no such thing as a perfect manager. But if I was to choose a manager close to it, it's Jurgen Klopp. And if anyone can get these boys fit and firing, and despite what's going on with centre-backs, etc., it's Jurgen Klopp. You just imagine that he just sits down with the players and he just says, look, this is a situation, we deal with it. We're Liverpool Football Club. It's an honour to play for this club. We go out there and we do what we do. We stick to our philosophy. And you can just see it. And long may it continue. I hope he extends beyond 2024. I hope he's here until he can't physically stand anymore. He's just he's brilliant, and we're lucky to have him as a manager.
Absolutely, well said. Sunday at 4, the team talk is this, boys. Tony fucking David Moyes up the Reds. That's been the weekender.
Sports Social Podcast Network.